very nice to be here, and thanks for staying for my talk. So I'm going to, I've been asked to give a tutorial talk today, and I'm cheating a little bit. I'm going to give a half tutorial talk, and I'm going to present some results. But I'm going to look at a very simple model, which in many cases is going to be linear. So some of the results are going to still be, even if I'm going to present some new results and some new ideas, it's still going to be a tutorial talk. And the topic I chose is the mechanism of frequency preference in neurons, and it's what's usually called resonance. So in our jargon, we say resonance. But resonance has various different acceptions. So first of all, I'm going to talk about subthreshold resonance or membrane potential resonance. I'm going to discuss about this a little bit. Then I'm going to present some biophysical models, some reduced biophysical models, which are the models that I'm using in my analysis. Then I'm going to talk about the relation between subthreshold oscillations and subthreshold resonance. And I'm going to go down to reduced and linearized models. It's a mathematical problem that can be solved analytically. And for linearized models, we can get formulas for the impedance function that I'm going to explain what is that later. But even with this, these formulas become very complicated, and we still need some tools to understand them. And these are the tools that I'm going to discuss. And then if I still have time, I'm going to talk about the dynamic mechanism of generation of resonance, which is an approach which I call it a dynamic phase plane analysis. Approach in which I look at phase plane analysis for external inputs. Now, what is the membrane potential resonance? So resonance, as in, people talk about resonance and they mean different things. When we talk about membrane potential resonance, then we talk about the ability of neurons to exhibit a peak in the subthreshold voltage amplitude response to oscillatory current inputs, but occur at certain frequency, which is the preferred frequency or the resonant frequency. If it's a linear model, then the output frequency and the input frequency are the same. If it's not a linear model, then there might be differences, harmonics, subharmonics, etc. Now, subthreshold resonance has been observed in many neuron types and also in networks. These are some of the references. There has been lately a lot of work about resonance, so I've included many references, but it's not the list is not exhaustive. Now, from the electric point of view, if we go into circuits, then if we have an electric circuit, not necessarily a neuron, an electric circuit that has only a resistor, then and we input a sinusoidal function. So this is what's called a zap function, which is a sinusoidal function that has all the possible frequencies. It trips over all the possible frequencies or within some range, so the frequency increases as time increases. Now, the frequency of the output is the same as the frequency of the input, but the amplitude changes, and it changes in a constant way. So if we plot the amplitude of the voltage response as a function of the input frequency, then we get a constant function. Now, if we have a circuit, a more sophisticated circuit, RC circuit with a resistor and a capacitor, then we have a low-pass filter. Low-pass filter means that the voltage response is higher for the lower frequencies, and we have this stereotypical shape, which is the shape of a low-pass filter. If in addition to that we have an inductor, then we have the resonance phenomenon. There is some frequency at which the voltage response is larger. The voltage response peaks at this frequency, which is the resonant frequency. And this is the same for a neuron. Now, these are all linear systems, so we see that the voltage response is symmetric. For a neuron, the voltage response need not be symmetric. In this case, it's not. And this one question is how the nonlinearities shape this type of responses. So the resonance is thought to be the result of the combined activity of high pass filter and a low pass filter that create a band pass filter. But all those things are not clearly understood yet. Now, from the cellular point of view, if we look at ionic mechanisms, then if we have a passive membrane with only a leak current, then we have a low-pass filter. It's a linear model, it's a one-dimensional model, and we have a low-pass filter as the same type of shape that I showed before. Now, the ionic currents, they are typically classified into two, into resonant currents and into amplifying currents. Now, resonant currents are these currents that are necessary to in order to create resonance. Two examples are an H current and a slow potassium current. The H current is a hyperpolarization activated current that Mike Hasselmo talked about in his talk. The slow potassium current is like the mirror image of the H current. The H current is inward, the slow potassium current is outward, but the H current inactivates while the potassium current activates. Now, the amplifying currents are currents that, in the presence of a resonant current, they amplify the voltage response. This is the definition of an amplifying current that you can find in this very nice paper by Hatchin and Yossi Yaron. But it's still not clear what are the roles of this of the amplifying current. Is it going to amplify the voltage amplitude response at the same frequency that is created by the resonant current at a different frequency? Will it have any the different role, etc., etc.? These are still questions that are not clear. At least they were not clear for me. Now, because of a couple of things I'm going to discuss later, I prefer to talk about resonant gating variables and amplifying gating variables to disambiguate in the cases of some calcium currents that activate and inactivate. They have an activation gating variable and an inactivation gating variable, and one is resonant and the other is amplifying. So for in order to disambiguate in these cases, we need to, I'm going to use this type of names. Now, the type of models that we are using are conductance-based models of Hodgkin-Huxley type. They've been discussed here before. These models have a capacitive current, a leak current, ionic current, which I sub X1, 2, etc., a constant applied current, and a time-dependent current, which is a sinusoidal current in the case that I'm discussing here. These are the formats of the currents that I'm using. I'm not considering here currents that activate and inactivate for the sake of simplicity. This is the kinetic equation that governs the dynamics of the gating variables. And I'm considering here, I'm taking two or three gating variables. I'm not giving names, I'm calling them X1, X2, and X3, because some of the things I'm going to see are more general. But essentially, I mean the gating variables, so the H current, the M current, the persistent sodium current, et cetera, et cetera. All the currents that are active in the subthreshold regime. I'm going to make a further assumption that one of the currents is much faster than the other, so fast that we can make the adiabatic approximation and make the gating variable equal to its activation curve. This is the case of some calcium currents and the persistent sodium current. Now, how do we measure subthreshold resonance? Well, we use the impedance function. Now, if we have a linear system, then if we input a sinusoidal function, the output is going to be a sinusoidal function with a phase shift, which is measured by phi. I'm not going to talk about phase shifts in this talk. Now, we can measure the amplitude response or the efficiency of the amplitude response by the quotient between the amplitude of the output voltage and the input current as a function of the frequency. We call that the impedance function. Now, the real impedance function is a more complex quantity, so I'm going to abuse notation. I'm going to feel free to call this the impedance function. And this is the shape of the impedance function, or a prototypical, a theoretypical shape when we have resonance. Now, if we have a system where that is not linear, then people use the Zap current. The Zap current, which I mentioned before, is a sinusoidal function that sweeps over all possible frequencies. Now, in order to calculate the impedance function, we have to take the Fourier transform of the output voltage divided by the Fourier transform of the input current. That gives us the impedance. And again, I'm being... yes. As I said, this is what I will call the impedance function now. It is a complex quantity, and the real impedance is the power, is the magnitude of this complex quantity, etc., etc. Now, for the sake of this talk, we don't need to discriminate between that, because we are going to talk about systems for which this distinction is not important. In any way, what the impedance function measures is how the quotient between the output voltage over the input amplitude. This is the essence. This is the information that the impedance function conveys to us. Now, we have having nonlinear systems, and these nonlinear systems have no subharmonics or supraharmonics, then we can filter manually the voltage response and take the maximum minus the minimum divided by twice the input amplitude, and we have a filter measure of the impedance function. The important thing is that this is what we characterize. And then the impedance function has some parameters that are going to be useful for us to characterize and compare. One of them is the resonant frequency. Another one is the maximum, what I call Z max. Another one is the difference between Z max and Z zero. And another one is this width, which I call it lambda. And for most cases, I'm going to consider the width between the resonant frequency and this other value. I call it Z1/2 because it's the voltage that the width of this impedance function when the voltage reaches half the distance between the maximum and zero. I always forget that I have my controller here. Now, why do we want to study resonance? Well, resonance is important because there are many results and we want to understand the resonance phenomenon. Most works have been done using current inputs, sinusoidal current inputs, but they will be more realistic. We want to construct a theory that helps us understand conductance inputs. And we want to understand what are the role of the nonlinearities in shaping the voltage response, and also what's the role of the timescale separation in shaping the voltage response. These are questions that have not been addressed, and we think they are important in order to have a whole picture of this phenomenon. If we understand that, then we will be able to understand how the sub-threshold voltage preferences, frequency preferences, are communicated from the sub-threshold to the supra-threshold regime, which we call firing frequency resonance or firing rate resonance. And now, in doing that, we got to the conclusion, and for reasons that I'm going to explain in a couple of slides, that sub-threshold oscillations and the resonant frequency, the frequency of the sub-threshold oscillations, what I call the natural frequency, and the resonant frequency are not necessarily the same, which brings us to the conclusion that sub-threshold oscillations and sub-threshold resonance are not necessarily the same phenomenon. And if they are not necessarily the same phenomenon, they are reflecting different timescales. And the timescale that the resonant frequency is reflecting is a timescale that is created because of the interaction between the sinusoidal input, or any input, any time-dependent input, and the intrinsic properties of the cell. And we call them emergent timescales. And we have also a concept of latent timescales, which are these timescales that are present in the single neuron, but are only uncovered in the presence of external input. And when we go to the supra-threshold regime, then we have the intrinsic timescales plus the emergent timescales and the latent timescales that can be generated in different phenomena. From that, then we expect to be able to explain some aspects of network dynamics. I did something wrong? Okay. Some aspects of network dynamics. For example, in our previous model of generation of theta rhythmic activity in the area CA1 of the hippocampus, the interaction between inhibit the basket cells and the OLM cells that have an H current generates this theta timescale, not because the OLM cells have the H current with its time scale, but because of the interaction created this this window of of in the theta regime. Now, as I was saying, there are some people that have claimed that sub-threshold oscillations and sub-threshold resonance are two manifestations of the same mechanism. Ilan Lampe and Yossi Aron have claimed that in 1997. Nicola Brunel and collaborators have claimed that sub-threshold oscillations and sub-threshold resonance do not necessarily reflect the same mechanism. And they show that in a very simple linear model. And as I say, from there comes our idea of looking at the emergent and latent timescales, which is what I'm going to try to explain now. Now, my main motivation in studying resonance comes from the stellate cells of the medial entorhinal cortex, which Mike discussed before. So this is one possible model for these stellate cells, which was proposed to study the synchronization properties of these cells, and we carried over to study other phenomena. It has sodium and potassium current and leak current. These currents are necessary for spikes. It has an H current and a persistent sodium current, and also an M current, plus the other currents that I explained before. The details of the currents are not really important. The important thing is that it has two, let's call them non-standard currents, and in particular the H current. The interaction between the H current and the persistent sodium current are responsible for the generation of substrate oscillations, which are the same substrate oscillations that Mike discussed previously. We have done a reduction of this model by taking away the spiking currents and making sure that the substrate regime is not changed, because we are only interested in substrate resonance here. So in our reduction, we took away sodium and potassium, the fast sodium and the delayed rectifier potassium, and we are left with the leak current, persistent sodium current, which is fast, so we can make the adiabatic approximation, and the H current that has two components, a fast component and a slow component. And overall, we have a three-dimensional system. From the dynamic point of view, we can take away this slow component of the H current, and the resonance phenomenon still persists, so we can even reduce this model into a two-dimensional model, which will be valid only in the substrate regime. The model will not describe the spiking activity. It will describe only the onset of spikes, but it will stop there. But it's good enough for our purposes. Now, these are results of the intrinsic activity of this cell, of these cells. The cell is nonlinear because of the persistent sodium and the H current. If we perturb the cell with different intensities or amplitudes, if the amplitude is very large, then we get this nonlinear response, which is expressed here by the nonlinear power spectrum. If the perturbation is small, then the response is almost linear. We see damped oscillations, and the power spectrum has only one peak. If we introduce noise, we deal with persistent sodium noise, because the persistent sodium channels are known for being noisy. We get substrate oscillations. All of them occur at theta frequencies. And here we have the power spectrum, which is not very different from this one. Now, if we want to understand dynamics, then we should go to the phase plane that was very nicely described by Hinke before. Now, for this would be the phase plane for the nonlinear response. This would be the phase plane for the linearization of the same cell. So this is like a nonlinear cell, and this is the linear counterpart. The nonlinear response is the blue trace here that corresponds to this thing. The linear response, the linear response, is the red trace here, which corresponds to this spiral. In both cases, there is a spiral. In both cases, the cell displays damped oscillations. But here, because of the nonlinearities, there is an extra amplification that is related to the canal phenomenon that was mentioned before, in which the trajectory keeps going for a while. Here, the linearization prevents the trajectory from doing this type of thing, so the response is much larger for the nonlinear model than for the linearization. Now, this is an alternative persistent sodium H current model, which has a cubic nonlinearity. The substrate oscillations are different, the phase response is different, and we expect the resonance phenomenon to be different. I took this model it comes from thalamic relay neurons, but if I switch parameters a little bit in my persistent sodium H current model for the stellate cell, if I change the persistent sodium current a little bit, I will also get a cubic null current, which means that I can switch from one to the other by a very small change of parameters, and then all the properties are going to change. Let me skip this. So this is here I'm presenting results of the voltage amplitude response to sinusoidal input for the nonlinear model, for this stellate cell model. In blue we have the voltage amplitude response. This is the envelope, essentially, the maximum minimum for different frequencies. In dust red, they are the results for the linearized model. As we see, there is a big difference between the nonlinear and the linear voltage response, which is expected because we saw these differences in the intrinsic behavior. This is the impedance function. This peak corresponds to this envelope, the red one that we almost don't see here corresponds to the red envelope here. And here what we show is that the frequency decreases as we increase the amplitude, I mean the input amplitude. For small input amplitudes, there's no difference between the linear, the real model and the linearized version. For larger input amplitudes, there is a big departure from, it's like 30% departure from the linear prediction. Our initial motivation was to try to explain why is it, how the nonlinear response was different from the linear response. But when we started doing that, then we realized that we didn't even understand the linear response. So that's why we started downgrading our study until we got into linear systems. Another interesting phenomenon that we found is that if we measure the time scale separation by this parameter epsilon, the time scale separation is essentially how slow is the edge current with respect to the persistent sodium current and with respect to the voltage. If the edge current evolves very slow, then epsilon is going to be very small. If the edge current evolves very fast, then epsilon is going to be very fast. And what we see is that the only parameter that we change is this epsilon, the time constant of the edge current, then the voltage response is very different from the linear voltage response. I mean, the nonlinear is very different from the linear. But if the time scale separation is not so large, 0.1, 0.2, then the nonlinear response is almost the same as the linear response. So in some sense, because of difference in time scale separation, then the nonlinear cell is not reading the nonlinearities, it's ignoring the nonlinearities, and it's behaving in a linear way. I am emphasizing that because when the first studies on resonance on stellate cells were done by the John White's group at Boston University and Andreas Hertz's group in Berlin, and there were controversies in the literature, but they were fighting about whether the stellate cells are linear or nonlinear. And what this result shows is that in the end, different animals can produce different results, different animals with different, at different stages of development with different parameters, life parameters, can show different results. That is not, we don't need to have different cells, we can have different time scale separations between currents that will explain this type of things. And this is another figure of the same thing that I'm going to skip. Now, if we go to the cubic model that I was explaining before, the one that has this cubic null line, then the picture is completely different. We have like harmonics, we have two peaks. There's a peak at 5 hertz and there's a peak at 10 hertz. Both peaks, the output frequency at 10 hertz is 5 hertz. And if we calculate the impedance function in the way we do it in standard way, then we will see only one peak because the impedance function measures the output amplitude with respect to the input. We plot it as a function of the input frequency, but what we are really doing is plotting the output frequency. As I told you, in order to understand those things, I need to first understand the nonlinear model. So I went and tried to use a linearized model. And the linearized model that I use makes use of these two new definitions. This voltage V bar is the fixed point, the V coordinate of the fixed point. X bar is the X coordinate of the fixed point for k equal to 1 and 2. And I'm using the type of linearization that was used by Nicola Brunel in their paper. And I get a linear system. I'm going to use here a two-dimensional linear system, but I'm presenting that for the three-dimensional case. And what I'm getting is a three-dimensional system, which is linear. It has an effective leak conductance, which is expressed here. It has two effective ionic conductance, G1 and G2, and two time constants, tau 1 and tau 2, which are the time constants calculated at the fixed points. Now, for G1 and G2, this is the expression that we get, and the nice thing of doing that in this way is that for an amplifying current, GK is going to be less than zero, and for a resonant current, GK is going to be bigger than zero. And we can have this, so we can perform our study by looking at the signs of G1 and G2. Now, another thing is that the effective leak conductance includes the original leak conductance plus information about all the ionic currents. And if we have a very fast current like the persistent sodium current, then it will have an extra term which is similar to this one, which will be included in this effective leak conductance. So the effective leak is not leak, but it's leak plus a lot of passive information about the ionic currents. For a two-dimensional system, then the model is going to read that. We can do a rescaling to reduce number of parameters. We can have additional effective leak and ionic conductances, which are going to be the original plus the time scales, etc., etc. And we can study this system, or we can study the original system. In order to do the analysis, we prefer to use a different type of rescaling. This rescaling is biophysical in the sense in that it keeps biophysical information about the conductances. We prefer to use this rescaling in which we can have a handle of the timescale separation and the quotient between, which is this alpha, between the two conductances. I'm going to switch from one to the other as I need it for my explanation. Huh? Yes, I can switch from one to the other. Yeah, there's. Yeah, I can switch from one to the other. There is only one notion of linearization. There are various notions of rescaling.
I like the polynomial matrix.
Yeah. Say that again?
I like the geometry description, not the
measure. Me too, but my experimental collaborators don't. So.
The personal is very confusing.
Yeah. But so I switch between one to the other to make everybody happy, except for myself. Now, here I'm using the geometric description, the alpha and epsilon. And what I'm showing here is here we have epsilon on the x-axis, alpha on the y-axis. And we should look at this quadrant. So here we have regions in epsilon-alpha phase in which we have stable foci and stable nodes. So here we don't have intrinsic oscillations. Here we do have intrinsic oscillations, which are damped oscillations. So above this blue curve, we have oscillations. Above this red curve, we have resonance, and below the red curve, we have no resonance. So what this is that, okay, we have regions where we have both resonance and subtertial oscillations, but there are regions where we have resonance without subtertial oscillations, or subtertial oscillations without resonance. And that depends on the timescale separation and the quotient between the conductances. Even if we have both resonance and timescale separation, even if we have both intrinsic oscillations and resonance, the resonant and natural frequencies do not necessarily coincide. So here, the solid lines show the resonant frequency, the resonant frequency and the natural frequency. Even when we have both, then the frequencies are different. Here we have, again, red is resonant frequency, blue is natural frequency for a different set of parameters, and the frequencies do not coincide. So the time scale of the intrinsic oscillations and the time scale that is created because of the external input are different. And these are our emergent time scale. This is, to emphasize this point further, we choose a point P, a parameter, so this parameter corresponds to alpha equal to 1 and epsilon equal to 0.2, which is this parameter there. For the solid line here, we choose a point alpha, and this is a plot of the phase plane when there's no input. So we see that there are no oscillations. We don't see damped oscillations. What we do see is this sag. So this the way that the trajectories evolve in a sac-like manner, as we see in the H current when we hyperpolarize it, or in the slow potassium current when we depolarize it. And that's a signature of resonance, but I hope to be able to make it clear later. So we have our linearized model, our linearized rescaled model. And what I will try to do now is to give you a flavor of the roles of the resonant current and the amplifying current and the time scales, and how do they create resonance. The main motivation for that is to try to understand, okay, how is resonance generated? So this is the model when there's no ionic currents. So no ionic currents present. It's a low pass filter. We should expect this type of shapes. If we calculate the width of this of the impedance functions, they increase with the value of gamma L, which means that the impedance function gets wider and wider. And phenomenon resonance is not only associated with the existence of a resonant frequency, but with the fact that the impedance is peaking. Because if we have a resonant frequency, but it's almost shallow, then there's not going to be a real and useful frequency preference. Here I'm plotting the Z max, which is the peak, which, as you see, it decreases as we increase the effective leak conductance. So this is just a simple thing. Now here what I took is a bandpass filter in which the effective leak conductance has been made equal to zero, and I use different values of the effective ionic conductance, G1 or gamma 1, which increase from blue to cyan. So what we see is that for gamma 1 equal to 0.4, we have a low-pass filter. Now resonance is created as we increase the resonant current gamma 1, not because the impedance function increases above this value, but because the Z0 decreases below the peak. So as we increase gamma 1, both decrease. I mean, the impedance function decreases and it gets more, it gets wider, but the resonant phenomenon is created because of this difference in between Z max and Z at 0, which is what some people call the Q value. And as you keep increasing the value of gamma 1, then the width becomes constant. In these two figures, I show the resonant and natural frequencies, resonant in blue and natural in red, as gamma 1 increases, and same here for Z max in blue and Z at 0 in red. And as you see, the peak stays almost constant, but Z at 0 decreases, and that creates the resonant peak. And here I'm comparing the results that I showed you before with similar results as when I increase the effective leak conductance. And what we see is that as we increase the effective leak conductance, I'm increasing the effective leak conductance from top to bottom, and from left to right, I'm increasing the effective ionic conductance. The overall picture stays the same. There are quantitative differences. Here we have a larger, the response is wider for gamma L equal to 1 than for the effective leak conductance equal to 0, and the resonant frequency is larger and the peaks are smaller. So as we increase gamma L equal to 1, then we get a lower resonance effect, or we get less resonance than for gamma L equal to 0. Now if we think of gamma L as a leak conductance, then that's okay because we are increasing the passive properties of the cell. But our gamma L or our GL includes also the effect of all the other ionic currents, in particular the effects of persistent sodium, which should be an amplifying current. So we should expect an increase in gamma L to have either less of an effect or even increase the resonant phenomenon, which we cannot get in this. It's not captured by this by the linear model. And here I'm doing the same for another value of GL. Now here I am taking a constant value of the a resonant current, and I'm looking at the effect of the amplifying current, of the effective leak current, from 0 to 4, going from blue to cyan. And again, what I see is that as I increase gamma L, then the resonant phenomena disappears. And on top of that, I see that I get some resonance frequency when there's no natural frequency, when there are no intrinsic oscillations. And again, this is not very clear to me. I mean, not very clear why that occurs this way. Again, because gamma L also includes I can increase gamma L without changing the leak conductance and by only increasing the persistent sodium conductance, and I will still get changes that are not clearly expected, which goes in favor of the claim that linearization is not always capturing the nonlinear effects. And this is the same type of thing for another value of gamma 1 to show that this is robust or pretty robust. In this figure, what I'm doing is I'm keeping G1 and GL equal to 1, constant value, and or gamma 1 and gamma L equal to 1. And what I'm changing is the time constant of the edge current, or the time constant of the resonant current, which increases from green to blue. Now, for low values, so I'm essentially measuring how the effects of changes in the time scale, intrinsic time scale of the edge current or any other resonant current have on resonance. For very small values of tau 1, which means if the resonant current is very fast, they will have no resonance. It's not shown here, but it will have a low pass filter, which means that a resonant current is resonant not only because of the, it's resonant not because of the current, but because also of its time scale separation. So we cannot say that the edge current, because of its feature of being hyperpolarization activated, is going to be a resonant current. It's resonant because of that and because its time scale is slow enough. So as I increase tau 1, then I get that the resonant phenomenon is amplified, the resonant peak gets peakier, and the resonant frequency moves to the left, which is quantified. Where is quantified? I didn't put it there. Oh, it's quantified here. So as I increase tau 1 from left to right, then for very low values of tau 1, there is no resonance. So if the cell is very fast, there's no resonance. Then the resonant frequency increases, it's blue, at some value of tau 1, and then the resonant frequency starts decreasing at tau 1 increases. So for very slow, say, H currents, then we'll have low resonant frequencies, which is consistent with the fact that the resonant frequency of a stellate cell, for example, is at about 4, 8, or 10 hertz, depending on the type of cells we are using. Here I am doing the same for other values of G1, for a smaller value of the resonant current, and clearly we get a phenomenon that an example, a lower response. And here I'm comparing both. So here we have a larger resonant conductance, here we have a lower resonant conductance, but the effect of the time scale separation is the same. So all those things, all those findings brought the question of what's the underlying mechanism? What is it that creates resonance? What is it that creates this time scale? And for that, we need to use phase plane analysis. Now, it is clear, in order to do that, we did an additional rescaling. We took the frequency out of the input, which now is going to be an input of 1 hertz, and we put it in, we did a rescaling, we rescaled time, essentially, and so the effect of the input frequency is, I'm okay with the time?
A minute or two,
okay. So the frequency is going to come here in the denominator of the right-hand side. So all the inputs will have the same frequency, but smaller inputs will have a slower response, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let me go to... Now, let me just show you a movie to make this point clear. If I manage to get so what I'm going to show you is the phase plane of the I'm going to show you the phase plane for the system This is the behavior of the system when the input frequency is very slow, very small, sorry. So what happens here is that the input frequency is very small. 1 over f is going to be very large. The voltage response is going to be very fast, and since it's very fast, it's going to be tied to the null plane. As time increases, as time progresses, then that shouldn't be here. As time progresses, time doesn't progress. Okay. As time progresses, then the null plane moves up and down, this red null plane, and the trajectory moves here. Now, if I put a very large input frequency, then the response is very slow because 1 over f is going to be very small. I put a frequency of 1,000. So the null plane is going to move to both sides, but the response is going to be very slow and it's going to sweep a very smaller voltage range. Now the question is, what is determining the, and this is the last simulation, what is determining the resonant frequency? And the resonant frequency is determined by the ability of the trajectory to move to this, I mean, to move freely up to this point instead of having to move up to this point. That would be for f equal to zero. When f is not equal to zero, then the trajectory can move very fast. With this, we are able to construct we can do that for all possible frequencies, we'll get different responses. So we are able to translate these voltage envelopes into this type of diagrams where we have the Vmax and Wmax of the voltage response, and we are able to analyze the dynamics for different parameter values. Again, we can solve the linear system with analytically, but we cannot learn much from the formula for the impedance. By using dynamical system tools, which I cannot, we don't have enough time to explain that in more detail, we can analyze the parameters of the model are going to be encoded in the phase plane, in the null plane, and the time is not encoded in the phase plane, but we can infer it from the voltage response, and we are able to obtain diagrams that help us understanding the role of the different parameters in shaping the voltage response. When there is no resonance, then we'll have this type of curve. When we have very peaky resonance, we'll have this type of response and all those in between. This type of tools can be used to analyze also nonlinear models and to try to understand further what's the role, in particular, of the nonlinearities and the different conductances and the time scale separation. And I'm going to stop here before they kill me. No, if you increase tau, you make it more resonant. The blue curve corresponds to tau equal to 100.